Down Press TV, the US decided for 1.4 billion English-speaking people on the planet that they can no longer watch and listen to news that goes against the US narrative. But why is it that a platform like Press TV faces so many restrictions? A recent poll by the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism paints a grim picture for the mainstream media. Not only are they losing their viewership, but their viewers also trust them less.
Trust in news is also declining and is lowest in the United States. On average, 42% of people said they trust most news most of the time.
Such news is not good news for the mainstream media, of course. People tend to turn to other sources of information that offer a different narrative, such as Press TV.
So the reality is that the Western media has played an absolutely diabolical role in terms of its kind of balanced reporting on West Asia as a whole. So not only Palestine, but Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Iran, that whole region. Western media has essentially been part of the terrorism that has been wrought on the entire region by Western imperialist military forces. The media in the West has really ridden shotgun and supplemented the psychological operations aspect of whatever they wanted to do in that region. What they want to do is obviously to subjugate the Yemenis, subjugate the Iraqis, subjugate everybody in that region to continue to maintain their hold on energy resources and various other geopolitical interests.
To get a glimpse of just how different Press TV is from other mainstream media, one can look at an open letter signed by more than 2,000 Canadian journalists last year about how biased their media is towards Israel.
Anyone who has worked in a Canadian newsroom has encountered the reluctance or resistance in covering Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Canadian style guides still ban the use of the word Palestine in their coverage.
After publishing the letter, some journalists even published another letter saying they fear retaliation over publicly discussing such matters. In a world where mainstream media even censors their own journalists for using the word Palestine, it is no wonder that a platform like Press TV has faced so many hurdles and bans.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen, the loyal audience of Arab English Radio, welcome to another episode of your very favorite youth station. Wherever you are, at any corner of the world, I hope you're doing just well. This is Asma, as usual, super glad to sit at the same table with you. And guess who is sitting next to me?
Zainab, yes. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is Asma's co-host Zainab on Youth Station, and we are super excited to be with each other on
the session. Exactly. Previously on Youth Station, we were talking about marriage and the causes of decline of marriage according to youth. We mentioned plenty much of causes. Economical causes, psychological causes, also dowry. We mentioned dowry, which is also a part
of
that.
One of the biggest reasons stay away from marriage, who are even informed and who are well-educated, who understand the importance of marriage, but because of this dowry system, since they cannot afford it, they kind of...
They have to hold back.
Yeah, they hold back and stay away from marriage.
Yeah, and then another reason was the intention to study and to get a great job and have an income and then get married.
We basically reached a point that people consider marriage to be a full stop on their education and a barrier to do jobs.
Exactly. And also we talked about responsibility and
escaping from responsibilities.
Lack of awareness about marriage and the fact that many youth do not consider any importance for marriage.
Exactly.
At the end of our discussion, we got to a very beautiful point mentioned by you. We talked about Sayyida Khadija and also Fatima al-Zahra and their marriage and how they did it. So simply, though they were women of great dignity.
Yes.
So now we are going to discuss the consequences of decline in marriage.
Yes.
What would it bring into society when marriage is not happening at the very appropriate time?
Disaster. To put it in simple words.
So very simply put, disaster is going to happen.
Yes. First of all, as we mentioned in the previous episodes, the first worst thing it's going to get is the haram relationships. Because need is there. Need is not going anywhere.
Yeah, the need is not going to fade away, no matter how much you ignore it.
Exactly.
The thing is that you would go for a wrong path to get what you want.
Exactly. I know couples who are not married to the people who loved in their teens. Who they loved in their teens, you know? What was the reason? Reason was that also in our cultures, in the past, we did not have the concept of love marriages.
Oh.
So it was really hard if you even have liked some person, then straight away go and talk to your family.
Mm-hmm.
So that way, not only one life got destroyed, one, two, three, and four lives, I think, got destroyed.
Plenty much of people were involved.
Yes, because how four people, you are involved with someone in your teens, and then you get married to someone else.
And the heart is broken, and plenty much of family members are so
oppressed. Exactly. Now it's not just two people who are suffering. Now it's just four people.
Why did this happen?
Because of the lack of awareness of the parents that they should come out of their strict behavior with the children, and at one point of time, they need to be friends with their kids. They need to be friends with their kids. If they are friends with their kids, like my dad.
And Zainab understand their children as human beings, not just their children.
I'll tell you, Asma, alhamdulillah. My dad, when I was 15 years old, told me, like, now you may have some infatuation towards some opposite sex. And if you ever had that, in our culture, it was bad. Like, if a girl goes and proposes a boy, or if a girl's family goes and proposes a boy's family, if I put it rightly right now. But my father came to my room when I was 15 and told me that day one, he growing up, and in case you feel a little infatuated towards someone, don't feel scared that I know it's not good in our culture, but I, being your father, am first your friend.
Such a great dad you have.
I'll go to the guy's house and talk to them.
Talk to him.
And even if they do not accept.
So thoughtful of your dad, Zainab.
And do not get into haram relationship.
That's a very good way. It's a model for the parents, actually.
Everyone who heard around in this society.
They were shocked.
Everyone was like, I wish I had a dad like you. You know what, Asma, what helped, how the statement helped me throughout my life? It helped us to stay away from that haram thing. Because we knew, even if we're getting infatuated, my dad was with me.
You knew that you have someone who's backing you up.
Exactly. And to put that in a right place, I won't say like there's someone who's going to help me. Okay, if you're liking someone, I'll tell the person my daughter likes you and go on. He told me I'll put it in halal relationship. I'll make it halal one. If you feel just infatuated, it's okay. You know, if your daughter is going to university.
Yes.
It's okay if someone likes her. Don't be like shocked.
It's natural, you know. Two genders are interested in each other.
If a person should get shocked, he should get shocked over corruption, over robbery, over other things, over other issues that are going on in the society. But if two genders, especially in today's age, in the age of social media,
in modern age,
feel infatuated towards each other,
the parents should be supportive and help them pave the road for them to get married in the right way.
Just see, what are your reasons? If you're not letting your daughter get married to a particular person, give your sensible reasons, but don't say, like, you know, sometimes our parents are like, they have not lived their own dreams. Now they live, well, they want to live their dreams
through
their kids.
That's the point, Zainab. Yes, you mentioned it pretty much perfectly. They had a dream, they couldn't achieve that dream, and now they apply that into their children's life.
I as a woman wanted to marry a doctor. I could not do that. Then you had the same dream for your daughter, but maybe your daughter likes an engineer.
Exactly. That's very true.
That's one of the biggest consequences.
So one of the biggest consequences was the fact that corruption would happen in society.
Yes.
Stay tuned. Thank you for listening.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Well, coming to another consequence is that you are getting older and time is flying. You never realize I'm still unmarried and there are grays in my hair. And day by day.
And actually, biologically, I'm not going to have children if I did not marry at the right
age. Exactly. That's one of the most important, because one of the reasons to get married is to continue the generation.
Yes.
The another consequence is you're not going to have children
at the right time.
Children at the right time. Mm-hmm. And as you age, you start having all those issues. You start having all those problems. You don't have children at time. Because your body is now not prepared. There was a particular time.
And Zainab, it's pretty much natural. As we grow older, we do not have that much of tolerance with kids or even with nagging people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, when you're younger, you can tolerate somebody nagging beside you all the time, saying things, blowing.
Answering them.
Yes. But as you grow older, no longer such a thing would exist in you.
And stop being self-centric. Because, you know, once you are thinking that, okay, even if I do late marriage, here you're seeing the positive part. I have seen older people having children. All right, even if they have. Just think your child kind of grows up and he has some kind of parent-teacher meeting in the school.
Yeah.
And all parents are invited. Just imagine how your child will feel like.
My grandparents are coming to the school.
Everybody has parents coming in, and my parents look like my grandparents.
Oh, yeah.
How that child would feel like, you know?
And also, Zainab, there are chances that if you marry at a very old age, then you would bring about some terrible children, you know? Some
exactly.
sick children. So the chances would grow as you grow older.
Yeah. And we have all these consequences because of one more reason that I would like to add to our reasons we were discussing is innovations.
Attached to the session the causes.
Innovations, Asma. You know, innovations, what kind of innovations we have in our marriages? Uh-huh. We have, I mean, I don't know. I tell you from my culture, there are so many in your culture as well, but I'll tell you from my culture. We give food to people on a wedding day. But on the wedding day, the same food is packed because you give them so much, number one. Just feed them only the much they can eat, okay? Mm-hmm.
You don't need the rituals, expensive rituals.
Rituals, and I call them innovations. Mm-hmm. That's bid'ah. That's innovation. That is not in...
Unnecessary things that have been added into those rituals.
Exactly. For example, now you're just cooking. We don't have, unfortunately, in my culture, we don't have just one food or two foods. We have 14 different kind of things.
Wow.
With rice. 14
That's
different
plenty
things.
Plenty much of things.
And everything is goes back to the meat.
Uh-huh.
Everything is made from meat. And how expensive
so
is that just to mention?
It would be.
So first of all, a father throughout his life is earning just to get her girl married.
Mm-hmm.
And when he, however he does that, he manages that. And he, even after the marriage of his daughter, he tries to pay the debt and everything else. You know what happens, Asma? People start talking behind the back. What kind of marriage this was?
So no matter how much money you spend on that, people
they
would
were 14
talk.
Things. Yeah, they were all 14 things, but it was not so tasty. Mm-hmm. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Surah Humazah, "Oh, while on these people, hell with these people who talk behind the back." We have a verse in Quran about backbiting, mm-hmm. but that's different. But this backbiting is different. The backbiting being talking about in Surah Humazah is that because the further verses explain that these people do backbiting because they have throughout their lives counted money, collected money, amassed money and count that. And because of the same reason that another person does not have money or does not spend much.
They're degrading them.
They degrade them and start...
So that was the cause. We were talking about the consequences. Just yes. for those audience who do not know what we're talking about. We yes. were talking about marriage, the causes. And now this session, we were talking about the consequences. We said that corruption would happen in society. And we said that people would be deviated from the right path. And they would go for haram relationships. Yes. Also, we said that
there would be
aware
no generation.
Of the biological clock that you have in your body.
Yeah.
You are not going to be as youthful, as healthy as you are today right now. And as you marry at an old age, there would the chances of bringing about children with a problem and sickness is going to grow as well.
Exactly.
So still we have a lot of consequences to say.
We do have, but I think these were the most important ones we discussed mm-hmm. here today.
And also, I would add one very important consequence, which is depression, Zainab.
Of course.
Since boys and girls are growing old on their own, they would turn into lonesome people who have got some terrible issues.
Yes, because
in most cultures, they do not even live with their parents.
If a person knows Islam and knows everything, and he is not able to, because of one or the other reason that we all discussed, not being able to marry at a particular time,
mm-hmm.
he won't go for haram relations either, but he will definitely suffer that loneliness.
Yes, exactly. So, dear audience, thank you for listening to us. We are running out of time, and we have to say bye.
Yes, inshallah, we'll see you in another session.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. Supreme Court this week embraced a vision of the Second Amendment that is profoundly at odds with precedent and the dangers that American communities face today. upending the long-standing practice of letting states decide for themselves how to regulate gun possession in public. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper and is titled, "The Supreme Court Puts Gun Rights Above the Human Life." The U.S. Supreme Court this week embraced the vision of the Second Amendment that is profoundly at odds with precedent and the dangers that American communities face today, upending the long-standing practice of letting states decide for themselves how to regulate gun possession in public. This decision reveals the vast gulf between ideologues on the Supreme Court and those Americans, ordinary people, and their representatives in Congress who want this country to be safer from guns. As the High Court issued its 135-page ruling, the Senate, across the street, approved an 80-page bipartisan bill that tightens restrictions on who can possess and purchase a gun. The House of Representatives passed the bill on Friday, and President Biden signed it on Saturday. This breakthrough came after decades of virtually no congressional action on gun safety and was fueled by public outrage over a series of mass shootings, including the recent massacres in Uvalde, Texas, and in Buffalo, New York. Gun enthusiasts and gun manufacturers have long sought a ruling like the one the Supreme Court delivered on Thursday, its decision in the case New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruen, is an assertion that the Second Amendment trumps reasonable efforts to protect public safety. The United States, as it exists today, awash in insufficiently regulated high-powered weapons and afflicted by staggeringly high rates of gun homicide and suicide, is a society that their preferred policies have created. The best that gun control advocates can hope for after the Bruen ruling is what Congress passed, gradual legislative tinkering. In its 6-3 ruling, the supermajority of Republican-appointed justices struck down a century-old New York law that placed strict limits on handguns. But the decision will also affect similar laws elsewhere in New Jersey, Massachusetts, Maryland, Hawaii and California. Many of those are states with some of the lowest rates of gun deaths in the country. Extensive research has shown the strict regulation of guns leads to much fewer deaths. Relying on a highly selective reading of history, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote in his majority opinion that these gun restrictions violate the court's new interpretation of the Second Amendment. It was only in 2008, with its decision in District of Columbia versus Heller, that conservatives on the Supreme Court divined an individual right to bear arms hidden somewhere in the 27 words of the Second Amendment. New York's law requires that a person seeking a concealed carry permit for a handgun must show a good reason for doing so, known as proper cause, which covers law enforcement officers and others who can demonstrate a reason to fear for their own safety. We know of no other constitutional right that an individual may exercise only after demonstrating to government officers some special need, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote. It is not how the Second Amendment works when it comes to public carry for self-defense. The majority left open the ability of states to ban guns from certain sensitive places, such as schools and government buildings, but it cautioned that there is no historical basis for New York to effectively declare the island of Manhattan a sensitive place. What about, for instance, the subway, the site of a mass shooting in April? The court didn't say, as Justice Stephen Breyer noted in his dissent. That leaves an opening for the states to decide which spaces are off limits. New York Governor Kathy Hochul plans to call the legislature back for a special session to address the ruling for just that reason. Lawmakers will consider legislation that could designate New York's public transit system a sensitive place, alongside schools, parks, hospitals, and office buildings, and buffer zones around them. The state should also institute extensive training requirements for concealed weapons permits. Lawmakers in several other states that will likely be affected by the decision said they were working to tweak their laws to meet the court's new standard for permissible firearms regulation. The Supreme Court justices bickered openly in their written opinions in the Bruin ruling, with the three liberals on the court pointing to various grim statistics on mass shootings and suicides, while Justice Samuel Alito asked what any of those deaths had to do with handgun regulations. Their discord reflects a grim truth about gun violence in the United States. It is several distinct and deadly crises happening simultaneously. Suicides by firearms, homicides related to domestic violence, gang killings, and spectacular mass shootings. Cities, states, and federal government have approached these overlapping crises in various ways and with varying degrees of success. Broadly speaking, regulating guns saves lives. More guns and less regulation of them results in more deaths. The new legislation aims to tackle several types of gun violence at the same time. Called the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, the law will enhance background checks for potential gun buyers under the age of 21, which might have helped thwart the mass shooting incident in Uvalde, Texas. It directs millions of dollars to states to put in place so-called red flag laws or other crisis intervention efforts, which will help stop domestic violence-related killings and also suicides. It adds serious dating partners to the list of domestic abusers prohibited from buying guns, which is now limited to spouses and domestic partners. It also directs millions of dollars to mental health and school safety programs. The specifics of this bill matter. Of equal importance is the fact that the bipartisan legislation tackles an issue that has stymied Congress for decades. It isn't quite true, as some supporters of the new bill claim, that there hasn't been any gun control legislation passed in the past 30 years. Congress passed, and President Donald Trump signed, a minor update to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System in 2018. But no legislation equal to the size of the problem has made it to a president's desk. With this new limited law, however, lawmakers are at least responding to the fundamental mandate of every elected government to protect its citizens. Given the political paralysis in Congress on so many other issues, any progress on guns is progress worth making.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, good manner and to joke.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of good manner and to joke. In the Islamic teachings, we see that to joke or joking is one of the kinds or one of the characteristics of having a good manner. But what does it mean when we say to joke with someone or to have fun with someone? When we talk about the jokes, generally what we see in the society, mainly the jokes are made to hurt specific race, maybe specific nation, or it is for people. Maybe we put different names on the people, we make fun of them, we make joke. And even when we say a joke, it is generally hurting someone in some cases. And when we see all these things and we say that this is a part of the good manner or husn-e khulq, this contradicts. On the other hand, when we refer to the Islamic definition of having a joke, it means, or to joke, it means that it should not hurt others. It means that to joke in a way so that everyone becomes happy. So you make your brothers in iman, you make the people that are sitting next to you, they become happy. And that's what mizah or the joke in Islamic definition means. And when we look at the even narrations from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he says, "Inni la imzahu wa la aqulu illa haqqa." I do joke, I do say, make jokes, but I do not say except what is haq, what is truth. And this does not hurt other people. It makes people happy. And this is what we need to strive for. This is what we need to go for. If we want to have jokes or to make jokes, it should be in a way so that it does not hurt others' feelings. Rather, it makes them happy, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the good manner and to make jokes or to joke in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that in Islam, to joke is a part of husn-e khulq. It is part of good manner. Whereas we see that when Yunus Shaybani, one of the companions of the Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, came to him and Imam Sadiq asked him that how much you fun, like you have fun with your friends when you're sitting with them or you say jokes. He said very less. And the Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said that do not be like this. Why? Because to joke is a part of good manner, and with this you make your brothers happy, you make your people, the friends that you're seeing with them, you make them happy. On the other hand, when we look at the Prophet, obviously in his life, there are many stories. For example, once the Prophet was sitting on the dining table with his companions, and next to him, Imam Ali was sitting, and they all were eating some dates. And the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when he had a date, He put the seed of date in front of Imam Ali. So the rest of the companions, when they saw that the Prophet, every time when he picks up a date, he eats it, and then he puts the seed of the date in front of Imam Ali, they started to put all those seeds in front of Imam Ali. When they finished eating, Prophet said to Imam Ali that, "Oh Ali, have you eaten all these dates that were in front of us? Because you know all the seeds are in front of you." Then Imam Ali replied nicely and happily, and he said that, "O Prophet, pardon me, but I was eating dates and I putting the seeds away, but all of you have eaten the dates with the seeds." So this was a joke which was made by the Prophet and Imam Ali, and this is to make happy each other. There was no insult, there was no abuse in it. And this was something which has been taught by the Prophet and Imam Ali, that when you're sitting somewhere, if you want to have a fun, you can have such things which makes everyone happy and it does not hurt anyone, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Agnes Callamard, the head of Amnesty International, who investigated Jamal Khashoggi's murder in her previous role as United Nations Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, said it was laughable that Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman could benefit from head of state immunity after the United States itself had concluded publicly that he most likely approved the operation to murder Jamal Khashoggi. We'll prepare for you an article written by Stephanie Kirschgassner. The piece is titled, Judge Puts Biden on the Spot Over Immunity for Saudi Crown Prince. A U.S. judge has asked the Biden administration to weigh in on whether Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, should be granted sovereign immunity in a civil case brought against him in the United States by Hatice Cengiz, the fiancé of dissident murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist who was killed by Saudi agents in 2018. John Bates, a district court judge, gave the U.S. government until 1st of August to declare its interest in the civil case, or give the court notice that it has no views on the matter. The Biden administration's decision could have a profound effect on the civil case and comes as Joe Biden is facing criticism for abandoning a campaign promise to turn Saudi Arabia into a pariah state. The U.S. president is due to meet the heir apparent to the Saudi throne later this month when he makes his first trip to Riyadh since entering the White House. The civil complaint against Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, which was filed by Hatice Cengiz in the Federal District Court of Washington, D.C. in October of 2020, charges that he and other Saudi officials acted in a conspiracy and with premeditation when Saudi agents kidnapped, bound, drugged, tortured and killed Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul, Turkey in 2018. Khashoggi, a former Saudi insider who had fled the kingdom and was resident in Virginia, United States, was a vocal critic of the young crown prince and was actively seeking to counter Saudi online propaganda at the time when he was murdered. After years of inaction against Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman by Donald Trump, who was president when Khashoggi was killed, the Biden administration moved to release an unclassified U.S. intelligence report in 2021, shortly after Biden entered the White House, that concluded the Saudi Crown Prince was likely to have ordered the murder of Khashoggi. At the time the report was released, the Saudi Foreign Ministry said the kingdom's government categorically rejects what is stated in the report provided to Congress. While Saudi Arabia said it held a trial against the hit squad responsible for the grisly murder, the proceeding was widely condemned as a sham, and some of the most senior members of the team have been cited in a state security compound in Riyadh. Other possible avenues of justice have been stymied for political reasons. A Turkish prosecutor in March ended a long-running trial in absentia, again against Jamal Khashoggi's murderers, in a move that was seen as part of the Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan's attempts to improve relations with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudi Crown Prince has taken responsibility for the murder on behalf of the Saudi government, but has denied any personal involvement in planning the assassination. For supporters of Hatice Cengiz, who has been an outspoken advocate for justice for Jamal Khashoggi's murder, any move by US government to call for the Crown Prince to be granted sovereign immunity in the case would represent a betrayal of Biden's promise to hold Saudi Arabia accountable. Abdullah Alouz, the research director of Dawn, a non-profit organization that promotes democracy in West Asia that was founded by Jamal Khashoggi and a co-plaintiff on the case against the Crown Prince, said, "It would be preposterous and unprecedented for the Biden administration to protect him. It would be the final nail in the coffin for attempts to hold Khashoggi's murderers accountable." District Court Judge John Bates said in an order released recently that he would hold a hearing on 31st of August after motions to dismiss the civil case by the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and others. The motions to dismiss the civil case rest on claims by Prince Mohammed's lawyers that the DC court lacks jurisdiction over the Saudi Crown Prince. District Court Judge John Bates said, "In the court's view, some of the grounds for dismissal advanced by defendants might implicate the interests of the United States. Moreover, the court's resolution of defendants' motions might be aided by knowledge of the United States' views." The judge said he was specifically inviting the U.S. government to submit a statement of interest regarding the applicability of the so-called Act of State Doctrine, which states that the U.S. should refrain from examining another foreign government's actions within its courts of law. The interaction of that doctrine with the 1991 law that gives Americans and non-citizens the right to bring legal claims in the U.S. of torture and extrajudicial killings committed in foreign countries. The applicability of the head of state immunity in this case, and the U.S. view of whether Saudi Arabia's sovereign interests could be impaired if the case were to proceed. Agnes Callamard, the head of Amnesty International, who investigated Jamal Khashoggi's murder in her previous role as United Nations Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, said, "It was laughable that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, whom she called an almost sovereign, could benefit from head of state immunity after the U.S. itself had concluded publicly that he most likely approved the operation to murder Khashoggi." Noting that Prince Mohammed bin Salman was not king, she added, "Mohammed bin Salman, as the Crown Prince is known, is not the ruler of Saudi Arabia, and the United States should not recognize him as head of state. Doing so would grant him an authority and legitimacy he certainly does not deserve, and hopefully will never receive." Jamal Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, could not immediately be reached for comment. The Saudi embassy in Washington was not available for comment either.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam presented a new model for the Islamic Republic, which was completely different from those two systems. Liberal democracy, which is based on capital, and communism, which is based on dictatorship. In Imam's model, certain dualisms became coordinated and harmonious. The dualisms that were previously attempted to be set against one another were brought together and harmonized. Imam put them next to one another. One of these dualisms was the execution of divine rules alongside observance of public expediency and interest. It was Imam who formed the Expediency Council. Some people think that it was I who established it. At that time, I was president. Imam wrote me a letter and held a meeting to establish the Expediency Council. Islamic rules were enforced, but the expediencies of the time and public interest were observed as well. This is what is meant by expediency. It does not mean showing certain consideration for individuals. Another dualism was attempting to the needy and insisting on economic justice, in particular economic justice, as well as generating wealth. Both the generation of wealth and justice in the case of poor must definitely be observed in Imam's viewpoints.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another dualism was the rejection of both oppression and accepting oppression. As a political system, government and nation, we will not oppress other governments and nations, and we will not accept the oppression either. We will not bully others, nor do we surrender to bullying. We will both strengthen science and economy and the defensive mechanism of the country. It was not the case that we only think of the economy and ignore the country's defensive mechanism and security. The opposite is true as well. Both national solidarity and unity and diversity and the existence of various political orientations must be officially accepted. This is another dualism. Officials should have both piety and purity and expertise and competence. How did he want to make this future distinct?
I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Highlighting the United States' rights violations at the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which the Islamic Republic calls the Den of Espionage. Every year in late June and early July, Iranian activists get together to commemorate the American Human Rights Week to recount instances of U.S. rights abuses in Iran.
United States, who is, you know, shouting the human right. We think that this is just a, you know, slogan without any background. And because when it's go to the Iranian people, we think we have seen that these people have been targeted, and we do not receive any apology about that.
The week-long occasion marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Rights activists say in all of those instances, the footprints of the U.S. can be traced. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board the doomed plane. More than three decades on, and Iran is still waiting for an apology from Washington. Rights activists believe the U.S. has not abandoned its double standards regarding human rights.
We know that more than 30 countries have received the negative sanctions from the United States. Sanction is something that violates the human rights, the right of the development, right of the education, right of the health.
The American Human Rights Week also marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast. The Islamic Republic says the MKO is responsible for killing 12,000 Iranians in different terror attacks. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been taking part in the terror group's annual summits in Paris.
They have withdrawn the MKO from the blacklist, and this withdrawal paved the way for the Americans, not only for the Americans, but also for the MKO, to extend their own terrorist operations through the facilities that they are provided from the Americans and also from the European territories.
The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls on the same period in the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Activists here say Washington has shrugged off its crimes in Iran, and that's why they observe the American Human Rights Week every year to take a jab at the U.S. for its selective approach toward human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Alina Lip, a German journalist who has been reporting from the pro-Russian Donbass region of Ukraine for over 6 months. She recently received charges from the German legal system threatening her with 3 years in jail.
On 24th of February, I shared on my Telegram channel the news that Ukraine is killing civilians already for 8 years. And I also said that this is a genocide and that people here in Donbass support the special operation of Russia. And this is a criminal act for Germany.
But Ukraine has been killing civilians here for 8 years. That's just incontrovertible.
That's a fact. That's a fact. I'm filming here for half a year now, and I'm living in Donetsk, and I'm hearing all the day this shelling around me, and this is not Russia.
And the other one, it says there is that you said that most people here support the separatists. That's a fact as well.
That's a fact, yeah, of course.
A few days after Alina's charge sheet was issued, the main German TV channel ARD ran a story reporting that the Russian army was bombing Donetsk, but they weren't. It was the Ukrainian army. The next day, the channel published a retraction and apology. It's not clear how many people who saw the report also saw the retraction.
The courts have also taken €1,600 out of Alina's bank account, money given to her by members of the public who are appreciative of her work. They also say that she is not allowed to defend herself at a hearing. Now, I've read the document, and the only conclusion I can draw from it is that either the German courts are trying to prosecute honest journalists, or that, frankly, they don't have even the most basic grasp of international politics. I'm not sure which one is more damaging to the credibility of the German legal system.
They just want to put me in prison for 3 years, but not hear me out. I mean, what? It's unbelievable. And especially they open this case because I'm sharing my opinion. So there's no free speech anymore in Germany.
Luis Cervera, an independent Spanish-Russian journalist who has been reporting on the suffering of the Donbass people at the hands of the Ukrainian army.
At first, I received a lot of hate comments, hate in general. Then I received also harassment from different people, pursued me. They published my phone number, all my private information. They even published an address of a flat where I used to live.
While Julian Assange faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life in jail, he is not the only journalist under threat of imprisonment for telling the truth. Alina, like many other independent journalists, have been deplatformed from some social media outlets and has had her PayPal account suspended. Anti-war sites Consortium News and Mint Press have also had their PayPal accounts suspended in an attempt to cut off funding.
The job of a journalist is to uncover stories so that society can debate and implement policy based on their findings. Now, while mainstream outlets don't even send reporters to this part of Ukraine, the few Western reporters who are here risk their lives and their reputations to uncover important truths. For that, they risk being deplatformed, smeared, or sent to jail simply for doing their job. There's increasingly a worrying campaign by tech companies, governments, and courts to strangle anti-war dissent in the West. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The recent decision by Moscow to cut its gas supply to Rome by 15%, which was announced by fuel giant Eni earlier this week, did not catch the Mario Draghi's government off guard, albeit consumer confidence in Italy is at its lowest level in over 20 years. On Saturday, Italy's ecological transition minister Roberto Cingolani said he remains confident that filling underground gas storage to 90% by winter, a requirement recently adopted by the Council of the European Union to strengthen the bloc's energy security, is still a feasible target. However, Minister Cingolani argued he expects prices to further surge, particularly after a temporary closure of the Nord Stream pipeline for maintenance.
We are definitely concerned over our gas supplies. Having said that, underground gas storage on our territory has been filled to almost 60%. So, let me tell you, we are doing fine in that respect.
Italy is trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for 40% of total gas imports. That's while prices in the country were 8% higher in June than a year earlier, marking the highest one-month increase in prices since 1986. The energy crisis has been compounded by an unprecedented drought that is sweeping through Italy's northern and central regions. Experts